It's Friday, April 26th, 2024, from Peachfish Productions. It's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. In news about powerful New York men adjudicated to have sexually assaulted women, with a case now playing out in New York courts. Mike, can you narrow it down? I can, because I have to. Well, in one case, there's former President Donald Trump, whose lawyer was before the Supreme Court yesterday, well, one of his lawyers, arguing that Donald Trump has absolute immunity from prosecution for acts as president. The court seemed to say, absolutely not, but they did say he just might enjoy some immunity. How much? In which cases? Well, that's for them to decide. They were at least, the conservatives were, which is to say the majority of the court, was at least a little immunity curious. When does he get immunity? Can you make a list, they seem to say, and might literally ask to lower courts? And you know what that means? Well, it almost definitely means no trial for Donald Trump in D.C. before the election. They say that justice delayed is justice denied, which brings me to the Harvey Weinstein case, jailed for 4 years, still jailed because of his California convictions, but the New York Court of Appeals has decided that Harvey Weinstein did not receive a fair trial. Talked about this on the show yesterday. I'll talk about it in the Saturday show tomorrow. I read the ruling. I watched the arguments before the court. I read all the New York Times coverage. I listened to the podcasts. And here I will play for you what was argued before the judges, and you will hear a dissenting judge, the chief dissenting judge, who wrote a fiery, fierce dissent in this case, Judge Singus. And her point is that the usual rules of evidence, which say that allowing witnesses to testify to a defendant's other bad acts, that should be loosened or allowed, because in cases of what is called acquaintance rape, the usual rules of evidence are inadequate to get proper conviction. Here's her making that point. You'll hear Weinstein's lawyer in response.
And amongst all the power plays of his power in Hollywood, his power over their careers, there has to be a different assessment, because sexual violence is different in these kinds of cases than in a stranger rape rooftop Vargas situation. Do you reject that?
I reject the fact that you think, with all due respect, Your Honor, and that's been the problem with this case in the lower court and at the appellate division, because he's an executive and who became the poster boy for a movement. There's a different standard.
I didn't say anything about a movie.
I know you didn't, Your Honor, but the bottom line is that it was so obvious that the jury did not need help figuring out his intent.
Last voice was Weinstein's lawyer, Arthur Idala, who is the host of the Arthur Idala Power Hour, weekdays on 970 The Answer. That's true, by the way. The issue that you heard there is, do we change or in some way loosen the rules that have protected defendants in New York State for over 100 years? Because if we don't loosen the rules, and the rules aren't fixed in stone, they can be reinterpreted, but if we don't do that, what's going to happen is that some rapists will not be successfully prosecuted. Or do we continue to afford rapists the protection of the law, on the off possibility that maybe they're not rapists? So what are those schools of thought? I think I'm trying to convey them fairly. You could say, well, one's expansionist and one's restrictive as regards the rules of evidence. Or you could say, I don't know, one's more pro-defendant and one's more pro-prosecution. That's definitely fair. You could say one's more pro-civil rights of the defendants, one is more victims' rights. I also think that would be fair. Here, though, was the taxonomy offered by Jody Kantor, the co-author of She Said, the co-breaker of the Weinstein story, speaking to the New York Times podcast The Daily this morning.
Let's call them two teams. The majority are basically behaving like traditionalists. Mm. They're saying things like, here's one line, under our system of justice, the accused has a right to be held to account only for the crime charged. Let's call the dissenters the realists. Mm. And they're talking about the way sexual crimes play out in the real world and what's necessary to effectively prosecute them. And they are incredibly critical of the majority. They use words like, I'm looking at the pages now, oblivious, naive, phrases like an unfortunate step backwards.
How could you ever say that it's wrong to be real? I mean, in every single case, when there are two sides, one's traditionalists and the other is realists, the realists are always right. I mean, if we're talking about the real world, the only way a realist is wrong is when you prove eventually that they weren't being real. To call one side the realist is to imply the other side is operating in a world of fiction, lies, or unreality, and to credit the stance of the quote-unquote realists as, of course, being correct. We do live in the real world, do we not? Also, traditionalists sounds like maybe a neutral term. There are people who describe themselves as traditionalists, but traditionalist doesn't have the same connotation as being correct. In fact, when we hear about traditions, we usually have to offer an explanation. Why do we do this? Why do we do that outmoded thing? Oh, because we've always done it. But why do we do it? Tradition, good song. Banger, in fact, but a bad explanation. And traditionalism does require an explanation. Well, why is this the tradition? And we say things like, well, it signifies the Last Supper, or it signifies having to flee Egypt in a hurry, or it signifies the prophet's own journey to his tribal home. And then after that explanation, we might say, but here's why it makes sense today, because just leaving it as tradition doesn't necessarily argue for its sensibility in the moment. And we say things like, oh, it provides us with a connection or a sense of shared sacrifice or some other explanation necessary to elevate the not terribly logical or relevant idea of tradition. So I think this is a bad framing. I do not think Jodi Kantor is in any way a propagandist. I think she's a great reporter. But it's not a neutral or, I think, fair way to think about this issue. And these are competing virtues for sure. Jodi Kantor might say, well, you know, it's not supposed to be a neutral framing. She'd probably say what it is a realist framing because the realists are in fact being real. You are not going to get rape convictions in cases of this type unless you allow in other bad prior act witnesses. That's what they were arguing about in the Weinstein case. Only they do get rape convictions in New York. They do get acquaintance rape convictions. And the idea that you're never going to get rape convictions is outmoded. One reason why these other witnesses who testified that Harvey Weinstein raped them or sexually assaulted them in cases that couldn't be brought before the court. One reason they couldn't be brought before the court is they happened decades ago. They were outside the statute of limitations. Well, and Jodi Kantor notes this, statute of limitations has been expanded, so you will be able to get more in. And also, mores and attitudes are changing. So a woman in 1993, as Annabella Sciorra, who, as was her case, and she wouldn't testify, many more women in such a similar situation today would testify, and then you would bring the case, and then you don't need to change the rules of evidence that defendants have always had, the scant rules of evidence that have protected them to the extent they have. You don't need to not just trample upon tradition, but trample upon principle and precedent, I would say. One other note, it was noted in the Daily podcast that the appeals panel had four women judges on it, but it was not noted that the breakdown of those deciding to throw out Weinstein's conviction was three women and one man, and those deciding that Weinstein shouldn't get a new trial was one woman, Judge Singus, who you heard from, and two men. Now, I don't think that's the biggest deal in the world, but you know, if the gender balance were in the other direction, that would be widely noted. So here I am, again, defending Harvey Weinstein, but I'm not. How can you tell? Because if I were actually the guy defending Harvey Weinstein, I wouldn't have a podcast, I'd have an AM radio show. The Mike Pesca Power Hour, and that doesn't even rhyme with Mike Pesca. Big difference there. We are both balding Italian men. But it is interesting to me that even if the judge you heard from wasn't referencing the Me Too movement, the journalist in that interview definitely did so unapologetically. And, you know, maybe she should have, because her interest and her assignment isn't just this trial, but it's the movement in general. And so that's fair, or that's fair enough. But I do long for the days when our reporters, our journalists, were both aggressive and judicious. If not equally, then at least sufficiently. On the show today, how about this? I've talked for a long time. How about, let's let that stand as the spiel. I will give you a long and informative and fascinating interview about a subject that you probably dealt with today or yesterday, Amazon. Dana Mattioli is the author of The Everything War, Amazon's ruthless quest to own the world and remake corporate power. They're further along than I ever knew. Excellently researched and written new book, Dana Mattioli, up next. So you've heard me say, perhaps in an ad in the recent past, that first we make our habits, then they make us. That is a quote attributed to the English poet John Dryden. I believe he was the first poet laureate. It is poetic. First we make our habits, then they make us. Let's talk about the inverse of that. What do we do when we want to get rid of a habit? What about when we think our habits are, let us say, unmaking us? Enter a product I'm here to talk to you about. It's called Fume. Fume is not a vapor. It's flavored air. So what it does is it takes one habit that maybe you're trying to kick and replace it with a behavior that has the look and feel of that habit, but not the detriments. It's pleasant. It's similar. It's replacing a bad habit with a different, more positive behavior. And now, with all orders, you could buy one, get one on their cores, which are their different flavorings. You could stock up throughout the year, these cold winter months, something to do, something to exhale, flavored air. So nice. And as a listener of The Gist, you'll get an extra 10% off when you use the code. Head to tryfume.com/thegist and use the code THEGIST for an additional 10% off plus BOGO cores to help start making the good habit that much easier. Thank you, Shaka Smart. This episode is brought to you by The Jordan Harbinger Show. You've heard me talk about The Jordan Harbinger Show because it's one of my favorites. He does in-depth interviews with some of the world's most fascinating minds. I can name a few: Barbara Boxer, Anderson Cooper, Michael McFaul, the Ukraine or Russia ambassador talking about Ukraine. One I recently listened to was Stanley McChrystal, the general, the former general, and he told an interesting story about revering Robert E. Lee. But then, after having a portrait of him for 40 years, he's a 63-year-old man, throwing it in the trash. Because his wife says, you know, what that picture and that man means to you, it doesn't mean to other people, and you have to understand that. And then in the interview, they got around to the point where McChrystal talked about that interview in Rolling Stone magazine that pretty much ended his career, where got to the desk of Barack Obama, and it had McChrystal saying unflattering things about the war effort, and just how he talked to his wife and how they decided not to be bitter and not to wallow in it. He could have taken some shots at the process, the reporter, or the president at that point, but he didn't. It was just an overall good interview. It was facilitated by Jordan's excellent interview style. Whether Jordan is conducting an interview or giving advice to a listener, you will find something useful that can apply to your own life in every single episode of The Jordan Harbinger Show. That could mean learning how to ask for advice the right way or discovering a little mindset tweak that changes how you see the world. Search for The Jordan Harbinger Show. That's H-A-R, like the first three letters in hard, B-I-N-G-E, as in how you'll want to catch up on all the episodes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Amazon's pretty big. You probably know that. Here's some stats. 200 million people pay for Amazon Prime accounts. It gives you access to their TV shows, and it gives you access to some discounts, and it gives them access to almost everything about you. There are 500 million Alexa-enabled devices in people's bedrooms, living rooms, and yeah, in some cases, bathrooms. They're also listening. And their cloud service computing company is the largest in the world. And I'll give you the ultimate expression of how big Amazon is. When I said Amazon, you did not think of the largest river in the world by volume. You thought of the retailer. This is all laid out in an excellent new book, deeply reported, but we're also going to get into some back and forth about implications. A new book by Dana Mattioli called The Everything War, Amazon's Ruthless Quest to Own the World and Remake Corporate Power. Dana Mattioli writes for The Wall Street Journal. This is, I think, an amazing achievement. Lots of great new reporting in here. Dana, welcome to The Gist.
Thank you for having me.
Was this your beat? Were you thrown into this, or did you get drawn to Amazon as a subject?
Oh, no, I was drawn to it. I was the Wall Street Journal's mergers and acquisitions reporter for 6 years.
Oh, so everything was being acquired by one company, and you
were
like,
not even that. All the CEOs, when I was covering all, who was acquiring whom, all the CEOs started getting nervous about Amazon. It started with the retail CEOs, and then the consumer CEOs, then the logistics CEOs, and then the healthcare ones. And it just seemed like this company was being invoked with fear in every single boardroom in America. They were starting to look about how to insulate themselves, how to Amazon-proof their business. And when it came time to leave that beat, I said, what's better than M&A? Amazon was the big black box of this company. It was inflicting all this fear, and I wanted to get inside of it.
Well, what does that mean to Amazon? I mean, I know from reading the book, but when business executives tell you they're trying to Amazon-proof their company, what are they talking about?
So some of them would bulk up and buy other companies to get bigger, to diversify, so that if Amazon got into their industry, they could ward them off. Some of them did stupid deals in pursuit of that.
Yeah.
But it's kind of telling to me whenever Amazon files a patent in a new industry or hires an executive from another industry, the markets watch. You know, Wall Street makes very vocal bets, and all the incumbents in that space, even if Amazon's not getting into it, there's a sell-off of their stock because Wall Street says, if Amazon wants to go there, it will dominate it.
So let's take a company that I think everyone knows. I did ads for them in 2015, a big company, Bonobos, which has an interesting corporate history. And I think they were acquired by Express, which just went out of business. It doesn't mean the Bonobos brand isn't doing well. But back when they were a burgeoning hot company, they knew that Amazon was interested in them. And this meant what for Bonobos?
So Bonobos and Andy Dunn, their CEO, fly out to Seattle for a deal talk meeting. And they were also, you know, being courted by other retailers and other giants. And Andy spoke to me for this book, and he said, this meeting was so different than any other ones we took. The team seemed really disinterested. They brought all of these other people to the meeting that stood to learn a lot from Bonobos' business. And they seemed close off. Someone was in the back of the room, like with his arms crossed, just taking down information, but not engaging much.
Right, right.
And he told me
they're supposed to be wooing this guy, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Like other meetings was a bit of a wine and dine, and you're the greatest ever, and here's
exactly
what.
Exactly. Right. And he said his quote was, it definitely felt like the probability of a transaction here was 0.0%. Okay, so he leaves the meeting. It's kind of strange. And then a few months later, Amazon launches on its Amazon's Basics line very similar khakis to what Bonobos made its name on. They look almost exactly the same. The flat front chinos, they're a fraction of the price. And he and his bankers felt like they were sort of there to be mined for information about how Amazon could better compete with them. There was no offer.
Yeah.
And he basically says, you know, he winds up getting acquired by Walmart. And he said the difference there is that at Walmart, when they were doing due diligence and meeting with companies about M&A or an investment, they had a very firm no phishing policy, meaning you don't take a meeting just to learn, to copy, to steal. You do it if you're really interested. And he felt like something else happened in this one.
Right. And Dunn goes on to say, he says it flat out, maybe a lot of CEOs don't want to say this because they're scared of Amazon, but he sold already. It's not a monopoly. He thinks they're a monopoly. He says it's not a monopoly through market share because they're very good at saying we're 1% of total retail. It's a monopoly through the fact that they're in 8 businesses and the collective impact that has on the ecosystem is monopolistic. It's a very clever way to do a monopoly because probably none of the 8 businesses could be identified as such, meaning a monopoly. But look at the aggregate impact on our ecosystem. Excellent point. Excellent chinos. What? Take it further. What is the impact? What did you find the aggregate impact was?
Well, I'll give you an example. And this is just in retail, but Amazon's this many tentacled octopus where it's replicating these sort of dynamics across other industries too. In retail, Amazon has become a bit winner-takes-all in some ways. They're 40% of everything sold online in the U.S. is from them. And it's hard for Main Street malls, other retailers, to compete. In 2018 alone, one study found that 700,000 retail jobs in the U.S. evaporated. Between 2001 and 2017, 18 times as many department store jobs were lost than in coal mining to show you like how decimated this has become. There's like the whole retail apocalypse has been the storyline, right? Mm-hmm. And when I speak to those CEOs of the mall retailers, the CEOs of the other retailers, they point at Amazon, that Amazon's fingerprints are all over this. But also they just, when you take these meetings, they have so much access to entrepreneurs because they're so big. All of the world's most innovative companies pitch them on being acquired or their VC arm for an investment. They take these meetings and so many of these entrepreneurs come out of it with a similar story to Andy's, where they say, hey, we opened up the kimono in good faith. We gave Amazon all of our data on our customers, our roadmaps, our technology, and then the same pattern played out time and time again.
Yeah.
They'd meet for months. Amazon would bring all of these executives to the meeting from other parts of its octopus to learn. Then the CEO or the founder would get ghosted. And then lo and behold, Amazon would announce the very same product months later, a year later, and the founder would have to contend with that.
You have this great anecdote in companies that people know, I think, drive this home. Carhartt, you know, the overalls, the makers of the somewhat tough-skinned industrial work garb. He's in a factory in China, and they're making the Carhartts there. And he looks in a corner and is like, what the hell's that? It's pretty much his clothes, but without his label. And he finds out, oh, that's just an Amazon knockoff. And that's, if he wasn't in the factory, the exact same factory at the exact same time, he never even would have gotten wise to this one aspect of Amazon's business practices.
Yeah, and that's the uncomfortable situation so many companies are in. Because Amazon is the dominant force in all these industries, their competitors have to work with them. They're almost a utility. So then you have this weird scenario where you're relying on them, but you're competing with them. And then what you're giving them is winding up in parts of their own business. And it, you don't have much leverage. They hold all the cards. It's a, you know, in the, when I was reporting this out, it occurred to me that Amazon is like the casino. The house always wins, and Amazon always wins.
Yeah. Here's other aspects. So Mattel is its own company and they make Barbie. But if Amazon's going to sell Barbie, and this was about a decade ago, and Toys R Us, which might not be the plucky upstart, but certainly is a company that's well established and got disrupted and destroyed mainly by Amazon. So if Toys R Us is going to sell Barbie, they could sell it at the same price. Okay, why would you buy from one or another? And the answer is, for many, many years, you didn't have to pay tax on Amazon. This is just killed whole retailers.
Yeah, they had two really big advantages early on that no one else had that they were competing against. First of all, Wall Street gave them this years-long pass on profits. They were able to grow and reinvest without showing any profits, where all of its competitors had to manage to the street quarter after quarter and couldn't invest in e-commerce.
Yeah.
So they blew ahead of everyone there. But then Jeff was like really shrewd. Like even when he was founding Amazon, he thought about trying to get it on an Indian a California Indian reservation so he wouldn't have to pay taxes. He couldn't do that, but he found the next best thing, which was find this tax loophole where mail order catalogs don't have to collect sales taxes in states where they don't have a physical location. So they're not a mail order catalog, but they made the case that there's similarities there. And it wasn't until 2017 in some states that they collected sales taxes.
Right.
And that allowed them to just steal so much market share from the rivals. Someone who worked on that for Amazon told me that that was their secret sauce.
There's a bunch of secret sauces. And according to that person, I'm sure he's right. But since there are eight huge companies in eight different sectors, I'm sure each one of them said, no, this is the real reason why Amazon is worth almost $1 trillion. But so
here, $2 trillion.
Yeah, yeah. Almost a trillion. I guess $2 trillion is almost a trillion. Okay, so first of all, on the Wall Street point, given Wall Street's incentives, they were right to allow Amazon not to have to show a profit for years. I think that that's the play. What you would say as a citizen is, okay, well, the government has to see that there is an unfair inefficiency. Certainly, some people are getting hurt by this. So the government has to come in and say no more. And eventually they did. But the question is, you would think there are all these retailers that know about lobbying, that have relationships with elected officials. Why didn't they do anything sooner? Toys R Us is not a small company. It's owned by a giant conglomerate. And so you paint this out through a number of anecdotes. And one is, for instance, how did Amazon essentially buy off Chris Christie and New Jersey in terms of, you know, pretty much decimating the sales tax economy of that town and having him say thank you?
Yeah. I mean, this is the funny thing about this. A lot of the CEOs were lobbying and saying, like, you guys, you know, got to help us. Amazon's got all these advantages. They're going to ruin our main streets. It largely fell on deaf ears. For a very long time, Amazon and the tech companies were held up as these bastions of innovation, job creation. They were really celebrated by politicians until more recently. But there's a scene in the book where Jerry Storch, who's the CEO of Toys R Us, is pleading with Chris Christie, then the governor of New Jersey, about Amazon and saying, you need to start taxing them. Like, they're having an impact on not just Toys R Us, which is one of the biggest employers in New Jersey, but all the companies that operate here. And it falls on deaf ears. And then not long after, Chris Christie's, you know, on stage with the head of public policy at Amazon for this big unveiling, and they announce a new warehouse in New Jersey for Amazon, and they're celebrating this, and, you know, Chris Christie's doing his victory lap, and it's going to create some jobs, but really not that many. I could pull it up, but I think I want to say it was maybe 1,000 jobs. And
but it's one of those things where you have the ribbon cutting ceremony in what's the town? Robbinsville, New Jersey. And those people definitely feel those jobs. But the collective disbursement of all the tax revenue, it's not as if one town is going to say, oh, you killed us. It's just that every town gets, you know, 1,000 cuts. So Robbinsville, New Jersey can get 100 chits, let's say.
Right. And then they, on top of it all, they give Amazon this sweetheart deal on taxes for a decade, which is like insult to injury. And, you know, if you just look at what's happening in the intervening years, I mean, Amazon's grown in New Jersey. Toys R Us files for bankruptcy. If you look at just the retail jobs in New Jersey, how much they've dropped over the last decade, it's kind of staggering. So it's just this juxtaposition of how the CEOs behind the scenes were trying to raise the alarm, but they were largely being ignored by some politicians that wanted to have the big press release and were maybe short-sighted.
What about Amazon's skill, ability, but tell me if it's unethical or unlawful, to mine the data of people selling on their site, to understand what customers want, and then to be able to take that knowledge, which the sellers provide, I guess, as a condition of selling things on Amazon, to take that knowledge and to make for Amazon to make its own products that, in some cases, put those sellers out of business?
Yeah, the seller relationship between Amazon and its sellers is just like really a fascinating dynamic. It's this very much love-hate, but bordering more on hate. They all need to be there because 40% of retail e-commerce is there. And Amazon knows that they have them, but they've been raising fees on them really steeply over the last decade. It's made it harder for these guys to, you know, protect their margins. And then on top of that, they all are worried that if I do something innovative, if I launch a great product, Amazon's private label team, where it makes its own goods, will come and look at my data and reverse engineer it and undercut me on price, and then I'm done. And that's happened time and time again. I have examples of the actual Amazon employees doing it to their sellers. And part of this is driven by this really cutthroat culture at Amazon. They do stack ranking. The bottom 6% of employees are cut every year. It's a really draconian, Machiavellian sort of environment. So employees are incentivized to do whatever they can to stay ahead, even if it goes against their own internal policies, which this does.
Well, yeah, that's my question. So when you're a seller, Amazon says that we will not mine your data, but the incentives are just so big and there's no way to stop someone who knows that if she's in the bottom 6%, she's going to get cut. There's no way to stop them from doing that. And it happens all the time.
And this was an open secret at Amazon, and people were turning a blind eye. So you could have the policies, but if it's not enforced, what does it matter?
So I want to get into a couple more examples before I turn it around on you and have you answer the tough questions. But just tell me about the culture. You talk about the cutthroat culture from the consumer side. Maybe they say they benefit from the cutthroat culture. Prices are low. Shipping is easy. Convenience is had. But there's this story about a worker who throws himself off company headquarters. What does that illustrate for you, other than the sad story of this person's actual horrible injury, not death?
So I would say that the culture sort of starts and stops with Bezos. There's a scene earlier in the book where he's dismissive of his early employees who are idealistic. And he says, you guys don't have a killer instinct. And he very much does have a killer instinct himself. And the company put in place these policies like stack ranking, like backloading pay for years 3 and 4, if you make it to years 3 and 4, that create this Hunger Games sort of scenario. And employees there live in fear of being pipped, it's called. It's performance improvement plans, because it's usually the precursor to being let go. And then you miss out on your restricted stock units. And there's a scene in the book that I think is just indicative of how much of a pressure cooker this could be. And yes, this is an extreme example, but I've talked to so many people at this company that have had to go on mental health leaves because of the environment. So there's this engineer, and he moves to Seattle. He's doing this work that he finds really fascinating. He's getting good reviews from his boss. And he then is put on a performance improvement plan, this PIP that people fear. And it affects his mental health mightily, to the point where he goes in one morning to the offices in Seattle and types out a suicide letter. Can I pull it up? Is that okay?
Yeah.
Okay. And he says, hi, everyone. This will be my last email in this world. I don't want you to mourn for me. I want you to learn something from my experience. And he details how he's been mistreated by the company and how this has cracked him. He calls his boss a murderer. And it ends with, I will jump off Apollo, which is the building he's in, and give my death to the murderers as a Thanksgiving present. And he says, if you have time, look out the window, watch me fall. He goes to the roof. He sends this. He copies Jeff Bezos, the senior management team at Amazon, and he jumps. Luckily, it wasn't fatal. He survives. I have the 911 call where employees are trying to help him, and you hear him like screaming in the background. It's like really brutal to listen to. And I just think that this is indicative of the pressure cooker. And I think how Amazon handled it is also indicative of how they deal with these sorts of issues. Instead of addressing it, instead of maybe making changes to prevent these sorts of scenarios from playing out, Amazon's response was to not address it and to delete the email from employees' inboxes and just ignore it. Mm-hmm. Instead of fixing like the underlying problem here, which has been well chronicled, you know, how tough of an environment this could be. And I think that shows just what these employees are facing, not just on the warehouse side, but this is like, you know, corporate job, white collar job. And I found a lot of examples where employees would tell me just how much of a stressful environment this was and how that made them do some of the more shocking behaviors in the book.
Do engineers at Google not have this problem? Do engineers on the floor of Tesla not have this problem? I'm just thinking of, you look, Apple workers. I'm not talking about the people in factories in China. I'm talking about the knowledge workers in America. This is a behemoth of a company. It's winning in the very cutthroat game of capitalism. If you work for the Navy SEALs, it's going to be a pressure cooker, and they don't lie about that. If you are an assistant coach under Bill Belichick, you should expect to be in the office at 5 a.m., but you'll probably win a Super Bowl within a couple of years of your tenure. So, you know, is Amazon that much worse, that much of an outlier of the winners of our economic system?
I've covered companies in some fashion for 18 years at the Wall Street Journal. This is by far the most aggressive Machiavellian culture I've ever covered. I think there is something unique to Amazon.
I remember when Walmart was the behemoth of American industry, and man, did they get so much incoming. And then Amazon essentially ate Walmart's lunch, and you don't hear so much about Walmart being terrible anymore. Is there a psychological aspect to it that, given everything you say and everything you document, accepted, this is a very tough place to work, and they also, and their practices ripple out to others in the competitive workspace of the American economy. But could you make the case that whoever is number one or whoever is dominating will take the incoming?
Yeah, sure. There's no doubt that Walmart was like the boogeyman of the 1990s, where people were picketing and didn't want them in their neighborhood, right? I would argue, though, that Amazon has gone so much further than that. You know, Walmart you could avoid if you want to. It hasn't become this utility. I'll give you an example. Even if you don't want to shop on Amazon, they're just so pervasive in this economy in ways that you might not even realize if you're not like savvy enough to know. You know, if you take an Uber or a Lyft, they're on Amazon Web Services. So you're benefiting Amazon in some respect there. You know, lots of different parcels in this country are delivered by Amazon Logistics. They've now superseded both UPS and FedEx as the biggest deliverer of parcels in the country, even though UPS is this 100-year-old giant. They usurped them in a matter of years. You know, while I was reporting this book, Amazon bought my doctor's office, One Medical. So now all my labs, my charts, my doctor's visits now reside with Amazon, right? Mm-hmm. So I just think the comparisons to Walmart in the 90s, that, yeah, there's some similarities there, but this goes so much further.
And we'll be back in a moment with Dana Mattioli, author of The Everything War, Amazon's Ruthless Quest to Own the World and Remake Corporate Power. We're back with Dana Mattioli talking about her book, The Everything War. And my question is, what about Amazon's status to their customers, consumers? I know that companies do polls, and I know that, for instance, Apple does pretty well in people's assessment, the consumer's assessment. Meta, i.e. Facebook, does a lot less well. What about Amazon? I know there was a time when they had the perception of their prices being especially low. I don't know if that's true now. How cognizant of people's perception are they? And what are they doing about it? Where does the American consumer stand on Amazon?
So the tide has definitely started to turn. I mean, definitely on the political landscape, you know, like I said, these companies used to be these darlings held up as innovators, and now there's been this tech lash. Yeah. And that has also filtered down to some consumer bases, but it's not as pervasive as the from the political angles, I would say. There's still 200 million Prime members and people, you know, like the service. But I would say that there are trade-offs and it comes at a cost. And one of the things I did with this book is I went back to some of the early employees at Amazon to get their take, right? A lot of them made a ton of money in their stock options at the time, right? They're all pretty wealthy, but they have misgivings about their time there. Some of them have canceled their Prime in protest. They try to shop local. Some of them have said that they feel badly about help building this monster, right? So I just think, I feel like that's really telling that they wonder about the broader effects of this company coming into the world.
One would have to admit, it's all in the book that there's a lot of genius to Jeff Bezos and Amazon. This isn't just muscling and bullying. There's true innovations. There's true insight. My question is, if he or the company were to act lawfully and ethically, would it still be a behemoth, a profitable company, but for the edging beyond up to the laws or even having that as an actual part of your strategy? We're going to get dinged sometimes in terms of breaking the law. If you take all that off the table, how successful would Amazon be?
It's hard to know. I still think they could have been one of the biggest companies in the world like they are without some of these tactics. I think some people within the company view some of the behaviors as such a distraction, as such an own goal. Like, why even go there? We're already winning. Why copy a small seller on the platform for a stupid private label brand when we don't even need to have those private label brands, right? Mm-hmm. So some of the people in the government relations side of the company and elsewhere just think, God, let's like just knock it off already.
Yeah. Or why be so averse to cutting down on counterfeits that you allow, there's such vulnerabilities with certain counterfeit items, as you chronicle, like a tourniquet. If a belt doesn't work, your pants fall down. If a tourniquet doesn't work, you die. And it would seem to me that Amazon, in its refusal to engage in any sort of crackdown, especially on extremely important items like that, is making a strategic mistake.
Yeah, I mean, there's another example that recently came out from the Consumer Protection Bureau where they had been selling carbon monoxide detectors that don't detect carbon monoxide. I mean, just think about what could happen there, yeah. Right? And I think a lot of shoppers on Amazon don't realize that 60% of what is sold is from these third-party sellers, and there's some great ones on there, but there's also fly-by-night companies selling dangerous products. And that could be a really bad scenario for your family if you're buying, for instance, children's toys with lead in them or a carbon monoxide detector that doesn't work.
So I was talking to my wife and we order on Whole Foods, which is owned by Amazon. Amazon's, by the way, the sort of company that you don't have to do, you know, self-disclosures because everyone knows that it's all part of their lives. Anyway, I said to her, what's your impression of Whole Foods since they bought it? And she said, I think the prices have gotten better and the service has improved. Are we under a misimpression from your reporting?
It's interesting. Most of the people I know who shop at Whole Foods says the quality have gone down.
The
I don't
quality.
Know about the prices.
Okay.
Yeah. But I would say the crux of the FTC lawsuit is that Amazon has raised prices on consumers because of some of their dynamic with their sellers. So, for instance, in the last 10 years, because Amazon is so dominant and because sellers need to be there, they've been able to raise their fees on those sellers. So they've gone up from like 19% a decade ago to 45% today. So for every dollar a seller makes, 50 cents of it goes to Amazon. And that means that some of these sellers that I've spoken to have had to raise their prices of their goods to protect their margins. And the FTC is saying, like, you're hurting consumers with this behavior. You're making things more costly. And by the way, you're not just causing prices to go higher on Amazon. You're causing prices to be raised throughout the whole online economy because of other other agreements you have with your sellers.
Yeah, see, because I thought the entire Whole Foods equal whole paycheck tire joke stopped being said, not just because of the sell-by date of the joke. It stopped being as true as it once was.
I mean, that might be the case. I haven't looked closely at the Whole Foods pricing since they came in. I hear more about the quality concerns.
So another question I have is, how much of this is just Amazon doing bigger and better what every other company does? There's reporting in your book about Trader Joe's. And when Trader Joe's has its meeting with Amazon, they're very aware when they have whatever dealings they do with Amazon, they're very aware of Amazon's strategy and penchant for essentially ripping off people who sell on their site. But I was just reading reporting that Trader Joe's does exactly this with artisanal, I think it was like garlic makers. They'll meet with someone, then they'll ghost the artisanal garlic maker, and then boom, 6 months later, a very similar brand of artisanal garlic shows up in Trader Joe's. So to go back to the original, is Amazon just better at cutthroat capitalism than even the people who are victimized by Amazon?
No, I wouldn't say so. I think Amazon goes above and beyond. I had a front page story last week about a secret shell company that Amazon set up called Big River Services. And the employees on this team were Amazon employees that lived a double life. They had a Big River Services email account. Then they would meet with all of Amazon's competitors, FedEx and eBay, and go to their conferences and get on their websites, take screenshots, take meetings with executives and get pricing information, and then feed it back to Amazon's senior team to rip off ideas or better compete with them. And they'd misrepresent themselves. And I think that just shows the extent to which this company will go to win when they're already winning.
So last thing I want to ask about is Lina Khan. She's a main character in your book. She heads the FTC. You start with her thesis when she's, or her writings when she's a Yale law student. The question I have, and you could talk about how Lina Khan is trying to take on Amazon, but I'll just quote from an article in a newspaper that's pretty good called The Wall Street Journal. Oh, yeah, you're right there. Lina Khan is taking on the world's biggest tech companies and losing. FTC's chair's court loss against Microsoft marks another setback in her fight to block mergers. I mean, as of late 2023, this was true. I think the FTC just actually passed a law about non-compete clauses. But give me an assessment. The book has a lot about what Lina Khan's philosophy is, and it sets her up as maybe the foil to Amazon. But can you offer an assessment if her strategy of even taking on these hard-to-win cases and not winning, has that hurt her overall ability to bring Amazon to heel?
Yeah, it's really interesting. So Lina Khan came in as chair of the FTC, which was an agency she was really critical of before joining. She thought they were kind of asleep at the switch, not doing enough, and she has a different view of what antitrust reform should look like. She thinks we should go back to this pre-1970s, 80s reinterpretation of the laws, right?
Yeah.
So she's railed against traditional, the last 40 years of antitrust enforcement. And she's come in, and they've had some lawsuits that were more fringe theories or novel theories, not like the consumer welfare standard theories, and they've lost. And that's definitely dented morale at the agency. People there are also worried that the losses set bad precedent for future cases, right?
Yeah.
And that's why this Amazon case is a big question mark. Like, will they win? It's hard to determine right now. But I would say this case seems a lot more careful than some of the other cases. At the end of the day, it's a consumer welfare case, the type of cases that she was railing against. This is like the type of cases that had been winning if you could demonstrate harm to consumers or higher prices for consumers.
Well, what are the exact parameters of this case?
The FTC is alleging that Amazon's an illegal monopoly, and because sellers rely on it so much, because it's you have to be there, Amazon has raised fees for sellers, which has made them in turn raise prices for consumers. So consumers are paying more, and then also consumers are paying more on other websites because Amazon requires that sellers have their lowest price on Amazon. So if you've had to raise the fees on Amazon to offset their, sorry, if you had to raise your price on Amazon to offset their fees, you've also raised your prices everywhere else.
Yeah. And I think this is important for my listeners to understand, which is that, yeah, it is true that Lina Khan had these, I don't know, I guess her critics would call them fringe theories or aggressive theories, and she lost on those theories. But exactly what you just said, this is not such a case. I mean, Lina Khan is critical of the establishment, you know, Robert Bork-esque theory that the only thing that matters is consumer harm. But even if she weren't, this is a very bread and butter, I mean, she would say it's very bread and butter case of consumer harm. This is exactly in the wheelhouse of what the judges who hear her cases have historically given consumers and the FTC wins on.
Yeah, that's right. And so when I've spoken to people, I mean, when you ask people if she's going to win this case, it totally depends on who you're speaking to. So that's the one thing. There's sort of a rift at the agency sometimes, and things have become a bit partisan. So there's that's at play, too, that, you know, one of their commissioners flamed out and wrote a scathing op-ed about Lina and her mission at the FTC. So things are a little bit different than they had been.
I assume in your own life, you take some you go to some lengths to avoid purchasing from Amazon for a couple of reasons. Is that
well,
am I right
have,
about that?
We have a Prime account. We use it for like Prime Video. We tend not to shop there that much. We also live in Park Slope where we have like a really good infrastructure for local shopping. So we tend to try to do that as much as we can.
But I guess my question is, there are probably some ways where you're like, oh, I'm generally trying to avoid Amazon. And then you're like, damn it, I just gave Amazon my money. Is that the case?
To your point, like, even if you take shopping out of the equation, like I take ride shares and I still go to One Medical. Mm-hmm. So I'm in their infrastructure for sure.
Do you have a subscription to the Washington Post?
I do. Yeah. I do. But well, that's not Amazon. That's Jeff.
Carve-outs. Carve-out for journalism, I guess. The name of the book is The Everything War, Amazon's Ruthless Quest to Own the World and Remake Corporate Power. Lots of scoops, lots of good writing, years and years of paying attention to the subject. Dana Mattioli is the author. Congratulations on the book. It was excellent.
Thank you, Mike. I appreciate it.
And that's it for today's show. Corey Wara produces The Gist. Joel Patterson is the senior producer. You know them as the Quaint Mallards. I know Michelle Pesca as the director of special projects for Peachfish Productions. The Gist is sponsored in collaboration with Libsyn's AdvertiseCast. For advertising inquiries, go to advertisecast.com/thegist. Thank you for listening.